Good morning, everyone. The first case for argument today is appeal number 06-4333, Indiana Right to Life v. Randall Shepherd. Mr. Patton.
May it please the court. This court should reverse the judgment below for two separate and independent reasons. First, plaintiffs do not have a justiciable case or controversy within the meaning of Article 3 of the United States Constitution because they lack standing. Second, and in the alternative, if this court reaches the merits, the Indiana Supreme Court's commitment canon and pledges canon do not violate the Constitution, for as the United States Supreme Court said in White, statements made in an election campaign pose a special threat to open-mindedness because the candidate, when elected, will have a particular reluctance to contradict them. After entry of judgment and full briefing in this court, the Third Circuit issued an opinion in an exceedingly similar case. We cited that in a letter of supplemental authority, the slip opinion, and it's now been published at 489 F3rd 156. The Third Circuit held that the plaintiffs in that case, Pennsylvania Family Institute, Ronald Cohen, and Charles Stump, lack standing. This court should reach the same result in this case as to the plaintiffs here, Indiana Right to Life and Arlene Sproul. Article 3, Section 2 of the United States Constitution limits the judicial power to resolutions of cases or controversies. No justiciable case or controversy exists here because plaintiffs have not been injured.
Let me just ask you this. Why isn't the threat of chilled speech sufficient to give Indiana Right to Life and the individual plaintiffs standing, third-party standing?
Indiana Right to Life and the individual plaintiffs are not judges, not judicial candidates, and are not subject to the canons. And therefore, they cannot be considered subject to the canons by which, and they're free to publish any information that they have. Now, on page 10 of the brief of appellee, it specifically noted that the commission has not threatened discipline. So there's no threat here, and the Indiana Right to Life is not subject to the canons. Now, what Indiana Right to Life and the other plaintiffs have to show is the existence of a willing speaker. They're claiming a right to listen to judges or judicial candidates speak. And in the absence of a willing speaker, there is no right to listen. Now, the district court in this case found that the plaintiffs themselves were willing speaker. But as Your Honor noted in your question, or as you were drilling down on it, Indiana Right to Life and Arlene Sproul are not subject to the canons. So they are free to say anything they want, publish anything they want, and do anything they want. They're not subject to the canons in any way, shape, or form. In this case, the plaintiffs have not met their burden of identifying a willing speaker. They have failed to show that any non-party judge or judicial candidate wanted to speak but for the canons and did not speak as a result of the canons. So that's the test here, is but for the canons, is there a judge or judicial candidate who wanted to answer the survey? Now, there were two judges who answered the survey, and Indiana Right to Life is free to publish those results. And those judges have not been threatened with any discipline. And what Right to Life is claiming, what the plaintiffs are claiming, is that though they can't publish because they fear that the commission may discipline those judges in the future. But that is pure speculation, conjecture, and surmise. They cannot stand in the shoes of judges and judicial candidates who, when Indiana Right to Life deposed each of these judges, each of those judges made it clear that they did not want Indiana Right to Life and the other plaintiff to bring the lawsuit on their behalf. Now, the other willing speaker that plaintiff assert is Judge Newkirk. And Judge Newkirk, when he answered the questionnaire, he checked decline. Now, the decline box indicated in a very lengthy footnote that the judges could decline to answer the survey if one of the reasons was they might be recused in the case as a result of this statement. So, and that has nothing to do, the recusal clause in this case was upheld by the district court, and therefore a judge can decline it on the basis of future recusal. And Judge Newkirk, when he was deposed by Indiana Right to Life, made it clear that he would not have answered irrespective of the canons, whether the canons were there or not. So in this case, the plaintiffs lack standing. Now, the plaintiffs attempted to recruit a judge or judicial candidate to bring the lawsuit. In fact, there was a judge, a judicial candidate, who sent a letter into the commission, and this letter was drafted by my colleague, Mr. Bopp, and the judicial candidate signed it, but then when he thought about it, he called the commission and said, I don't want an advisory opinion. I don't need to know. I don't want to be part of this lawsuit. And so that person...
The candidate who was worked as counsel for the plaintiffs at one time?
He was a candidate who worked as an intern for...
Intern in the counsel's office.
Intern, and as a favor to opposing counsel, he signed the letter and then called up the commission and said, I don't want an advisory opinion.
Said what the movies used to say, include me out.
Include me out. Exactly right, Your Honor. And because there's no judge or judicial candidate who says, include me in, they lack standing. That's what this case is about, a lack of standing. So standing deals with who is the right party to bring this lawsuit. And that has to be a judge or a judicial candidate, which we don't have here. We know that the plaintiffs tried to...
The best kind of a plaintiff you could have is a candidate who got censured.
That's correct. And that leads to the...
That's the Buckley case, the Illinois case.
That's right. Yeah. Right, Your Honor. There was a judicial candidate who was disciplined.
And see, I've been around so long, I was on that panel. So.
Yeah. Wasn't that long ago, Your Honor. I think 92.
Actually, Judge Bauer has been around so long that he would be subject to the mandatory retirement age of 75 in Indiana.
Well. Absolute fact, tomorrow's my 81st birthday, so hang in there.
Happy birthday, Your Honor. But that leads
still
to...
sharp as a tack.
That leads to the second argument related to justiciability, which is not only is there a lack of standing by these plaintiffs, but it's also not ripe for resolution because there has been no threat. In Buckley, the judge had been censured, had been disciplined. And as I said, on page 10 of their brief, they note that the commission has not threatened discipline. So in addition to a lack of standing, who is the right party to bring the lawsuit? We don't have a judge or judicial candidate. There has been no threat of prosecution. And as such, the action is not ripe, even if they were successful in recruiting a judge or judicial candidate to bring the lawsuit.
And, of course, the commission is fully aware of this lawsuit and the depositions that were taken and the issue of whether Indiana Right to Life wants to publish it. So if they wanted to jump in the fray, they could as well in terms of indicating what their views are.
Exactly, Your Honor. Now, even before the lawsuit, however, the Indiana Supreme Court's commission issued a preliminary advisory opinion after the United States Supreme Court decision in White that tried to give guidance on this issue, and the counsel for the commission is also available to give guidance to the commission.
Well, you don't have too much time left here, but why don't you just assume for a minute that there is standing, that we have a proper plaintiff, and the lawsuit is ripe. Talk about the merits of the constitutionality of the pledge.
This is a very important question, Your Honor, and we submitted, there was two amicus briefs that were submitted in support of our party. This is an issue that's being litigated around the country. The Indiana Supreme Court commitments canon and the pledges canon are constitutional. They're narrowly tailored and to vindicate the compelling governmental interest in protecting the due process rights of litigants and future litigants and to protect the appearance of impartiality in the judiciary. The United States Supreme Court in White, if you read that opinion and you look at each of the discussions of the pledges clause, the pledges canon, or the commitments canon, what you will see is Justice Scalia talking about the pledges canon and holding it up as constitutional. He specifically says that statements made in an election campaign pose a special threat to open-mindedness because the candidate, when elected judge, will have a particular reluctance to contradict them. So Justice Scalia in White is distinguishing between on the one hand, the announced canon, which was struck down in White, and the pledges canon, which is what's at issue here, and the commitments canon. Now, the canons in this case are also different than in White in that they're not under-inclusive as the canon was in White. While an announcement carries the same meaning either before or after an election, a pledge, promise, or commitment, when on the campaign trail and on the campaign stuff, is particularly dangerous to the process. Imagine a judge during a state judicial election saying, I will always award custody to the mother in a family law dispute. And then if the judge gets on the bench, what is the judge to do? And that's what this case is about. And there's basically two constitutional issues.
What kind of problems are sort of inherent in an elected system? Now, having been both an elected and an appointed judge, believe me, the appointed judiciary, as Judge Bauer would certainly agree, is superior.
States are free to choose to have election for their judges, and they should have some.
It's a shame, isn't it?
No, that is not.
I, too, was elected. First time. Appointment's much better. Easier, too.
Yeah, less expensive.
Well, states have the choice to have elections, but they should be given some leeway because of the due process concern, this tug of war of constitutional rights that are at stake. Due process on the one hand and the First Amendment free speech rights. These canons are narrowly tailored to protect the due process rights, unlike the announced clause in White.
Voters of Indiana are, I guess, misguided enough to vote for somebody who would pledge a position on cases, why should that be the concern of us? The Constitution.
The Constitution, the due process concern. If you look at Justice Scalia says, I'm not deciding pledges, promises, or commitments. But the dissent, four justices in dissent say pledge, promise, and commit are constitutional, and Justice Scalia doesn't want to address this issue. So what you see, if you go back to White and you look at each of the discussions of the pledge and promises and commitments clause, it's almost implied that they're constitutional. So what I would urge is a review of White.
Wouldn't the appropriate question always be to a judge, will you follow the law whether you agree with it or disagree with it? Same pledge we ask of the jurors when we ask them to listen. Will you follow the laws I give it to you whether you agree with it or disagree with it?
Right, and a judge can't.
Doesn't that cover the question that we're discussing?
You can promise that.
Yeah, I know, but I said, wouldn't that cover the question you're discussing?
The way the canon is written, it says only with respect to, I don't have the exact language in front of me, but there's an exclusionary provision that shall not pledge, promise, or commit except for, and then there's a provision after that, which pulls out the administration of justice, which is what you're talking about.
But not just the administration of justice. There are a lot of people, a lot of times that a judge follows the law as enacted either by Congress or the state legislatures or has been decided by the Supreme Courts of either the state of Indiana or the United States and follows them whether he or she disagrees with them.
Right.
There they are. That's the rule.
Right.
And that is in this court, for instance, we write on the shores of Lake Michigan, not the banks of the Potomac, and all we have to do is see what the Supreme Court has done. Now, if there's a brand new one floating around, that isn't encompassed in any of the questions that's propounded. Not one of them. Those issues are already in the illegal milieu. Where? So, you know, what difference? Well, the answer is I follow the law.
Right. But what we're dealing with here is whether right to life can compel judges to answer certain questions.
Yeah, but the question
they can't compel.
Yeah.
They can't compel you.
Can they?
Well, they're in a sense by trying to strike down these canons, trying to get judges to speak.
What they're trying to do is put them in a political box where they have to answer a question that they want the answer a particular way, and if it isn't that way, we're going to vote against you. It's a terribly simple. It's a blackmail process, as near as you can tell. There you go.
Yes, Your Honor.
An effective BRCA. But they're not, it's not unique to this group. There are a lot of groups that ask the same thing.
Right. But the question is, I mean, for instance, the judges who...
How about a question, are you in favor of putting a cap on punitive damages? Is that allowed under the canons of the judicial in Indiana?
A cap on punitive damages,
yeah,
for a judge to express that view?
Yeah.
That sounds like an announcement, which would be protected by the First Amendment, and not a pledge or a promise or commitment as to how they would rule. Yeah. So one of the things that you saw, I'm into my rebuttal time, but I want to make one point, is that the Indiana Supreme Court, after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in White, moved away from its prior statements in this area. It used to be that they didn't want judges to say they were pro-life or pro-choice or tough on crime. Or
you're in your rebuttal time, but keep rolling.
Right. I understand, Your Honor. And but what the Supreme Court did after White is it moved back and said, we're limiting our review just here to the pledges and promises and commitments. So it responded to the United States Supreme Court. Thank you. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Fine. Thank you. Mr. Bob.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. This case is about implied promises, not a promise, a pledge or promise of a specific result in a particular case. The commission has specifically disclaimed that they want their canons to be limited to that sole category of speech that this court in Buckley and the U.S. Supreme Court in White suggested could constitutionally be limited, and that is pledging or promising certain results in a particular case. In their opening brief on pages 51 and 53, in their reply on page 20, they specifically disclaim that they want their canon to be limited to that narrow context. They explain in the preliminary advisory opinion that it is implied promises, where you make a statement about an issue that goes beyond the most general kinds of statements, like I'm pro-life, to say...
Could your group ask a candidate how he would square his religious belief with the rules of law as they exist?
We did not ask that question.
No, can you ask that under your theory? Is that a perfectly appropriate question?
Yes, it would be. You're not pledging or promising certain results in a particular...
How can you reconcile your position, for instance, as a Roman Catholic on the in face of the fact that we have a right to abortion? Can you ask that question?
Yes, that could be asked, because you're asking about the judicial philosophy.
Might get you a punch in the nose, but I mean, I suppose you could ask.
Well, it may, Your Honor, but the... But it is an important question that is often raised, and that is whether or not people with certain beliefs are able to follow the law. And, of course, we want assurances.
Well, that would encompass almost every religious group in the world, wouldn't it?
Yes, potentially.
Yeah,
these are not questions that are typically asked, and no, not by my group, certainly. But you could ask about people's general judicial philosophy, their general opinion, and how
Baptists are against drinking. How do you feel about laws that permit drinking?
Yes, whether or not you're going to follow the law.
You can ask pretty much anything you want to ask, can't you?
Under the Constitution.
But I think you better spend some time on standing here, because I'm troubled by why you have standing to bring this lawsuit.
Because the commission, in every possible way, has made it absolutely clear that you cannot answer this survey without being disciplined, without being subject to discipline.
They haven't disciplined anybody, have they?
Yeah, and
well,
they
have not, because their chill has been effective.
Oh, don't you think candidates sometimes are like to say, oh, you know, I'd love to answer your question, but, boy, I can't because of the... Get me in touch with the commission.
And that's exactly what numerous judicial candidates have said in this case. Look on supplemental appendix page 24. You see an answer to a questionnaire where the judicial candidate said, quote, and he wrote this in here, on advice of Meg Babcock, I declined to answer. Look at supplemental appendix page 16.
Well, but that advice was probably not a good idea to answer. It wasn't that you answer that question and you're going to be... put in the dock or something.
That is what she said, and she said that in a letter to Indiana Right to Life, that I've been telling judicial candidates not to answer this questionnaire because the ramifications under the canon, the commits and the pledges clause.
I would tell a candidate if somebody asked me, I wouldn't answer any of these questions.
Well,
whether they're by the pro-life side or the pro-choice side or the pro-death penalty side or the anti-death penalty side.
Judicial candidates are perfectly free to make that answer.
Yeah, and then once they make that choice, why can't judges and judicial candidates bring suits themselves? I mean, no judicial candidate has brought a lawsuit against the commission. No judicial candidate has said their rights have been chilled by the commission. I mean, that's who should be in here.
Well, but the listener has an equal constitutional right to receive speech.
Well, how are you affected? How is your ability to publish these questionnaires affected?
Because
you
judicial
can still go ahead and publish the two judges who chose to answer. You could still publish their answers.
But this court has held that a prohibition on a third party gives standing to a listener, someone who wants to receive that speech, to bring suit in his own name. The two cases are Shimmer, S-H-I-M-E-R, and Penny Saver. In both of those cases, there was a punishment not on the plaintiff, but on, in one case, advertisers, on another case, on guards in a prison. And the person who was injured by not receiving that speech or benefiting from those activities brought suit, and this court in both of those cases held that they had standing. And Indiana Right to Life has an independent right to receive speech as a listener, and that is a constitutional right that they themselves have. And, of course, they themselves have been chilled in the exercise of their own speech because of the prospect of punishment on people who have answered these questionnaires, which is why they have declined to answer these questionnaires. Now,
But if we go along with your thinking, couldn't any political interest group or member of the public have standing to challenge the canons on any grounds?
Well, no, not any ground. I mean, it would have to be a speech.
Well, related to someone's views, related to a potential candidate's views.
It would have to be a limit on speech that chilled judicial candidates from providing the speech that the plaintiffs have a right to receive that is protected under the Constitution, which cannot be suppressed by government by imposing penalties on someone else. And, of course, this court has not held, they have not held that you have to find somebody that absolutely says that I would answer these, but for the canons. This court in Shimmer uses the phrase may hinder the flow of information in majors, may deter potential supporters from doing things to support candidates. And in Penny Saver, the court specifically speaks of people who are not before the court, who may be deterred as a result of the government action. And of course, the reason for that is that if you had a situation of total effective suppression, that is, a 100% chill of speech, no one would even consider speaking if the government was that effective in ensuring that speech be suppressed. And we have exactly those situations. We have Judge Newkirk, and you can find this on Appellee's Supplemental Appendix at 20 through 22. He said that when he called Meg Babcock, quote, that I hadn't made a decision how to answer. He had three options, partial answer, all answer all of them, or answer none of them. And then he said, as a result of the phone call,
that's file a lawsuit seeking declaratory judgment.
Look, judicial candidates, don't just file lawsuits against the disciplinary authorities in their state, without serious consideration. And nor is it required. If his speech is chilled.
But see, you're trying to protect his speech.
Mm-hmm. No, we want to receive his speech. We have a right under Virginia, in the Virginia case, to receive the speech of that speaker, an independent right under the Constitution to receive that speech. Now, Judge Brown, who did answer, was quite candid. She said, I answered, but I did not know that Meg Babcock, who the record shows, speaks for the commission, is authorized to provide this advice, and does so based upon the canons, that Meg Babcock had been telling judicial candidates not to answer these questionnaires. And she said very plainly that if I had known that she was giving that advice, I would not have answered this questionnaire because I don't want to do anything that might run me afoul of the commission's views on what the canons say. And of course, that specific testimony goes beyond the other statements that are made in the record. Meg Babcock says that in summarizing her advice to judicial candidates, telling them as an official government official speaking for the commission, telling them not to answer these questionnaires based on the canons, she said that she did not know what that they all agreed, and this is on page 47, that they all agreed that they did not know what the ramifications of answering, and therefore no one should answer the questionnaires. And what she was talking about was the legal ramifications, whether or not judicial candidates would be
might
prohibited.
Be the political ramifications she's discussing as well.
Well, but no, she was. If you look at it in context, she
was
talking about
legal. If
you look
at it this way, if they enact the ethical things to protect judges from being forced to put themselves in a box with particular groups that want to ferret this out.
Well, there's no question about that.
Yeah.
There's no question there's a motive here.
Well,
is
there anything impure about that motive?
Well, it just runs against the Constitution
the
problem.
No, it doesn't.
Well, that very issue was resolved by your court in the Buckley decision.
Sure it was, and I told you, I was on the panel. I remember the issue wasn't quite that.
Well, it was indeed. It was this very identical prejudices and promises canon.
What it did have is a judge who was disciplined for exercising his constitutional rights.
That is true.
And nobody in this case has been even threatened with it.
You've held numerous times that in a pre-enforcement facial challenge, you don't have to have a threat of enforcement.
Well, there's got to be a threat to somebody that's in the party. It's part of the
suit. Well, look at Wisconsin Right to Life versus Schroeder, recent decision of this court.
Well,
it said specifically, number one,
I follow the law, so I remember it.
Okay, you do not have to have a threat of prosecution, and that prosecution is inherent in the statute. So you don't have to have the enforcers saying anything. The enforcers here are saying at every turn, you can't answer these questionnaires.
Yeah, but what distinguishes this case, these candidates could file suit. And even though you're saying for practical reasons they may not choose to file suit because they're worried that there might be repercussions from the commission or it might hurt their chances, most of the cases talk about a third party standing in the shoes of an individual when that person cannot assert their rights effectively.
Well,
and here these judges can, because all they have to do
the
is
standing.
File a lawsuit. There may be some risk, and there may be some things they have to weigh, but they are not blocked from filing a lawsuit.
We're not asserting that standing. We're not asserting test jurisdiction standing where we are asserting their rights. We're not saying that. We are asserting the standing that Schimmer and Pennysaver, what this court found, that a plaintiff had the right, i.e. an advertiser was prohibited from advertising in Pennysaver. All right? Though the prohibition was on somebody not even in the lawsuit or the court. And the publication, Pennysaver, brought suit and said that prohibition denies them their speech rights, and I am injured by the prohibition on them. Now, and here we have an independent right to receive the speech, so we are injured in that way as well. Now, to go to the merits for a moment, if I might, this case is really identical to the Buckley case. We have the identical canon, the identical pledges and promises canon. We had the court, the Seventh Circuit hold that that canon swept too far because it swept in, quote, implied commitments, end of quote. The canon was not limited to pledges or promises to rule a particular way in a particular case, and nor was the canon susceptible to that narrowing construction. We have the same grounds here. We have the claim that they want these canons to go beyond pledges and promises of particular results in a particular case to implied commitments. They don't want it narrowed to pledges and promises about particular cases. And they say that three times. In case we missed it, on 51 and 53 of the opening brief and 20 of the reply. So we have all the issues on the merits that were at issue in Buckley have been litigated already. Whether you can, it is constitutional to encompass implied commitments. And they say those very words in the preliminary advisory opinion. It's implied promises that they want to punish. Now, the Supreme Court decision in Republican Party of Minnesota versus White has simply demonstrated this court was right about its analysis, that the Constitution fully applied, that only pledges and promises of certain results in a particular case might ever be constitutionally acceptable, as this court held it was would be acceptable to regulate those, and I agree that it would be, and but that implied commitments are simply another way of restricting people from announcing their views on disputed legal and political issues, and that is exactly what was protected in White. The due process issue was fully litigated in White. The Supreme Court explained that, number one, that the Eighth Circuit based its decision upholding the canon in part on the due process rights, and that the litigants in the Supreme Court were arguing due process rights were the ones that were being one of the rights that supported the announced clause. So the issue of due process rights of litigants has already been fully adjudicated by the Supreme Court in terms of its potential application to this matter. It is our view that this court has a much more robust record before it. It has numerous letters, written statements, deposition testimony from judicial candidates about how either they felt outright prohibited or equally as significant, Judge Dieter said in 2002, found on the Appellee's supplemental appendix at 145, that it was the uncertainty that was engendered as a result of this preliminary advisory opinion and the lack of clarity by the U.S. The Indiana Supreme Court on the applicability of these canons that uncertainty resulted in him refusing to answer these questionnaires. But you really, there is no uncertainty that this commission views answering these questionnaires as subjecting the people to discipline. You can find on the Appellee's supplemental appendix at page 61 their answers to requests for advisory opinion. Requests for admissions. And there they said, quote, parts of the questionnaire ask questions that may elicit answers, which suggest the judicial candidate's predisposition on issues, which in turn may commit or appear to commit the judicial candidate to rule in a particular way if these facts are presented to the judge. They answered similarly with respect to the pledges and promises clause, and then in their interrogatories on found in Appellee's supplemental appendix page 63 in their answers to interrogatories, They just combine the two of those and say that, yes, parts of these questionnaire ask questions that may elicit answers that, that fall under commits and pledges clause. So, you know, in every possible way, they have either told judicial candidates that they would be they could be potentially subject to discipline because answering these questionnaires would run counter to the canons, or they have created the degree of uncertainty by the ambiguity of the preliminary advisory opinion that it has simply resulted in a chill of those who are asked to answer these questionnaires, and as a result triggered numerous judicial candidates explaining that these are the problems which have meant that they are not willing to answer these questionnaires. So we believe that we have established you know, the type of record upon which this court can apply its precedents and find not only standing for the challenge which has been presented, but that these canons are unconstitutional. Thank you.
Mr. Patton, anything further?
Yes, Your Honors, just two brief points. First, with respect to standing, my colleague discusses the Majors case, and in that case, the speaker was subject to the regulation themselves. In this case, there is the plaintiffs are not subject to the Indiana canons. They're not judges and not judicial candidates. My colleague also relies on Penny Saver. That's a case in which the advertiser had actually been punished. In this case, there's been no judge who's been punished. So I'm not sure that that relies. And as Judge Williams points out, any political group then would be able to have standing, and there's simply no limit that I see in the principle that has been proposed.
You want to address yourself to the Buckley case?
Yes, Your Honor. And the first point I'd like to address on Buckley is the point that you made right at the beginning, which is that was a case in which a judge had been censured. In this case, we don't have a judge who's been censored. The second point is, in Buckley, the commitments canon was not at issue. It was not decided upon. In fact, it was the reference that this court made to it was this perhaps is a saving interpretation. So the commitments clause is different. And the third point I'd like to make in White, I think I'd like to focus the court in on what the U.S. Supreme Court said about pledges, promises, and commitments. And I think in the majority, when they specifically said statements made in an election campaign pose a special threat to open-mindedness, because the candidate, when elected judge, will have a particular reluctance to contradict them, suggests that there is support in the United States Supreme Court for the Pledges and Promises Clause. Unless the court has any further questions, we respectfully request that the court reverse the judgment below. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, counsel, both sides. The case is taken under advisement.